Welcome to the Commentary Magazine podcast. This is Monday, February 13th, 2017. I'm John Podhoretz, the editor of Commentary. At my left, Noah C. Rothman, associate editor. Hey, Noah.
Hi, John.
And Abe Greenwald, senior editor. How are you, Abe?
I'm doing great. Hi, John.
So we are a day before Valentine's Day, and basically the entire week has been the opposite of a Valentine for Michael Flynn, the National Security Advisor, who has been basically a giant pinata all week for the press and for people inside the White House and for critics and everybody else who are desperate, it appears, to claim him as the first Trump scalp. And it is astoundingly early for somebody to be nailed in an administration if he ends up going sometime this week. Because of the various issues involving his veracity in talking to the vice president about a supposed phone call that he had with – not a supposed phone call, a phone call he had with the Russian ambassador at the end of December, in which it was claimed he had discussed lightening sanctions or eliminating sanctions on Russia during the incoming Trump administration. And he was defended against that charge by Vice President Pence, and now there seemed to be documentary evidence that he did discuss sanctions, and he says he can't remember whether he talked about it, and no one else is really talking about it. And as this is going on, terrible stories are being leaked about the dysfunction and general what sounds like utter madness of the behavior of the National Security Council, whose staffers are getting up in the morning, reading the president's tweets, and then attempting to design policy around them or something like that. So I have some issues with this but that are different from the conventional issues. But Noah, what is your take on the causes of this frenzy of anti-Flynn activity, I would say almost everywhere?
Well, it's not – I mean, this is a new level. The intensity is extreme this week. And it's been catalyzed, obviously, by the leaks of some of this information regarding Mike Flynn's call and the contradiction – call with Russian officials and the contradiction of Mike Flynn's earlier suggestion that he hadn't actually done this, specifically – to members of the administration, and even more specifically to Vice President Mike Pence. But this has been kind of going on since November 17th. I mean, when he was selected, we had just this deluge of leaks from people within the intelligence community and outside the intelligence community, unattributable sources who were saying that Mike Flynn is a problem. And a lot of that could have been attributed to the fact that when he was at the Defense Intelligence Agency, he tried to reorganize the agency and make it more mission-oriented, and that put a lot of people out. And then he had some interagency politics and some bureaucracy politics, and I'm willing to dismiss some of that as just that, as just, you know, people being protective and vindictive and jealous. The story that we had in the New York Times in particular yesterday with regard to how the National Security Agency is conducting itself is perfectly believable, particularly because of the ascension of Steve Bannon to a post on the NSA or NSC. And the notion that really concerned me, the notion that this mid-level policy staffer, Stephen Miller, is chairing a meeting of the national security deputies seems to me completely inappropriate, and a suggestion that Mike Flynn is not taking his role seriously enough to justify his current position. So even if you don't think that a lot of this criticism is justified on the merits, the accounts of how he's been managing his arm of the administration, national security, is really disconcerting, and it sort of retroactively justifies all these leaks from intelligence community members who were warning for months that this guy was going to be a problem. Lo and behold, he's a problem.
Okay, so here's the problem with the Flynn leaks as we're discussing them, which is the leaks. I don't mean the leaks where people express negative feelings about him or just talk about him in ways that are demeaning or defamatory or even, truthfully negative. I mean that it appears that the intelligence community that wishes to show Flynn the door is quite evidently leaking high-level, highly classified, sensitive information as a weapon against him. And this is very frightening and should concern people. Perhaps you remember that there was a 3-year investigation conducted by Patrick Fitzgerald that led to the unjust conviction of Louis Libby, the chief of staff to then Vice President Cheney, who didn't even leak the name of Valerie Plame, the undercover agent at the CIA, whose husband had become a ideological enemy of the administration. And yet, to hear the left tell it over the course, and liberals tell it over the course of those 3 years, what someone had done simply by leaking her name was an act of infamy so great that no punishment could be too severe. And right now we have the intelligence community, evidently either they have they're tapping Flynn or they're tapping the Russian ambassador's house or phones, and releasing information from those calls, which is A, totally illegal, B, a threat to national security in and of itself. If they are revealing sources and methods by releasing this information, and a terrifying, I would say, intrusion of the intelligence community into the policymaking process and the personnel process of a new administration. And nobody is focusing on that except Daniel Pletka of AEI, who wrote a very good piece about this today, saying that the key issue here is this, and that everybody is instead focusing on the juicy story of whether or not Flynn will be the first scalp of the Trump White House.
Right. I mean, before this story broke, it wasn't sort of common knowledge and discussed in public that intelligence was tapping the phone of the Russian ambassador to the U.S. If getting that information out there is a sort of way to bring down Flynn or to try to bring him down, it's perhaps too high a price to pay.
And if it's not that, if it's that there is some investigation into the Russian meddling into the election, and Flynn is somehow in that, in a secret, you know, target FISA court, whatever investigation, so that it has become permissible for his communications to be monitored by somebody. The fact that that information is leaking out should terrify every American, because that means that evidence being gathered in the course of a confidential investigation in which there are no indictments and nothing has happened and no one has been told that they're a target of investigation or anything like that. That is one form in which government starting to act like a tyranny. I mean, that, you know, when you release information, you know, there's essentially like raw police files or raw investigative files with literally no reason to do it other than to embarrass a person, which is really why it was done. Now, having said all that, these stories about the way the White House is working and the way the National Security Council and the National Security Staff is working are horrifying, and there's no other word for it. They're horrifying. Whether it's appropriate or inappropriate for Stephen Miller, the 31-year-old aide in the White House who, you know, spoke at Trump's rallies and was the communications director for Jeff Sessions and is now clearly a very powerful person in the White House, whether it's inappropriate in an odd way is not for us to judge. The president can do whatever he wants. These are not confirmable posts. He could ask you to chair a meeting. It's of no consequence to me. This is stuff that is not overseen by the, you know, not advise and consent stuff. This is the interior workings of the White House. Having said that, it is bizarre. It's not maybe appropriate or inappropriate. Obviously, many things that we have considered inappropriate for the course of our lifetimes are going to be standard working order in this White House. And it's like this whole argument about whether or not, you know, we should be normalizing Donald Trump or not is beside the point. He normalizes himself because he's the president. So what he does becomes normal by definition. And so if it's okay with him in the White House when he hears that Stephen Miller ran a meeting. Stephen Miller ran a meeting. Now it's appropriate. But why Stephen Miller would be running a meeting when he, you know, knows as much about foreign policy as, you know, anybody listening does because he reads the newspaper, that's another question.
But I think that's a big question. I mean, and I think it has to do with a number of deficits at the top. I think Donald Trump, there's a vacuum of knowledge, experience, and an understanding of how policy is made. It's sort of like everyone is all the roles beneath him are bigger than they normally would be to account for the fact that he's doesn't seem to be terribly involved.
All of this strikes me as the Trump administration so far in these 3 weeks strikes me as the building upon really disturbing precedents that were set in the Obama period. The leaning on the media to report on terrorism in a way that supports a White House narrative about the increase or decrease thereof is something the President Barack Obama did very explicitly and shamelessly, and the Trump administration has taken that ball and ran with it. The conduct of American foreign policy in a political fashion to execute political objectives, to change domestic political priorities, is an Obama administration precedent, not a precedent per se. It's been done before, but they did it very shamelessly and without regard for decorum and the stature of the presidency. And they're building upon that precedent in this White House. And that's something conservatives should be very concerned about.
And I'm sorry to interrupt, but also they did without regard for leaks. I mean, the Obama administration loved getting out there that they collaborated with the Israelis on Stuxnet, for example, in order to make a case that they were cooperative on Israeli security.
And this is and conservatives know this. They have mentioned this. They have made an issue of this. It's not as though they're saying that this hasn't happened before, but they're going about it as though it's justification for what's happening now, and not something with which you should be recoiling from.
Well, there we have the crux of a major issue here, which is you have to separate out certain types of wheat from chaff. So one of them is the willingness of, you know, critics of the administration to pretend that every action the administration is taking is unprecedented and horrifying and suggests a politicization of a process that is, you know, just absolutely untoward. And as Noah, as you just pointed out, that's absurd. It is absolutely not true that, you know, Trump was the first person to demand the resignations of ambassadors. Like that's always a standard issue thing, or that agencies are told to stop making regulations or to issuing diktats through regulation because there's a new administration. As our really fine article and commentary by Tevi Troy this month, which I heartily commend to you at commentarymagazine.com. explains, this is how every administration begins, with a concern to make sure, particularly if it's an administration that is of the opposite party and has an opposing policy to the one that was sitting, wants them to stop until they can get hold of the mechanics once Inauguration Day takes place. So there's been a lot of this nonsense about how, you know, Trump is doing things in a new way and it's horrifying and it's Nazism and all that. But there are things that are new and that are unprecedented and that are – or if they're not unprecedented, they're terrible. And the fact that so many of our friends on the right are willing to say, well, Obama did it too, or, well, when Obama did it, you didn't complain, is all well and good. But just to make it clear, we complained. You know, they complained and we complained. And so saying that, you know, the New York Times didn't complain is meaningless. That's just to make a nya-nya at the New York Times. It doesn't deal with the actual fact of the policy problem that is created by Trump violating constitutional norms, for example.
More ominously is that we're watching this sort of build upon itself, and we're not seeing anyone put the brakes on it. This is clearly people building on precedent and then citing precedent to justify their actions. So what's the next administration going to bring? What's the administration after that going to bring?
Which is what we all said during the "we can't wait" Obama onrush into, you know, assuming legislative powers because he was irritated by the fact that he had a Republican Congress who wouldn't rubber stamp his policies. And so He started writing executive orders as though they were legislation, and courts overturned them and overturned them and overturned them. And we said, this is very, people like us said, this is very dangerous because you're establishing the precedent that the president should be asserting powers and then daring the courts to over, as opposed to obeying the you know, precedent and the history of the Constitution and believing in the separation of powers and saying, I can't do anything until Congress acts. Executive orders are issued to fulfill the diktats of legislation that was passed by Congress and signed by the president. It is not to make specific policy that has the effect of legislation. So, and then you have the fact that we should talk a little about, which is the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals decision to uphold the stay of the executive order, you know, suspending visas and the refugee policy. Because here you have an interesting phenomenon. And the phenomenon is that, as Michael McConnell, the really remarkable legal thinker at the Stanford Law School, puts it, this was a terrible decision, you know, basically as a result of a terrible executive order. So the executive order was incompetent, overreached, badly drafted, badly thought through, and it resulted in a response by the courts that, far from meaning that the presidency will – presidential powers are going to be enhanced over time, was a real gesture in the realm of judicial supremacy. I mean, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, one of the reasons in which it stayed – one of the reasons it gave for staying the executive order is – that future possible immigrants and illegal immigrants might have their due process rights violated under the terms and conditions of an executive order like this. Future. So there's no – there literally, not only is it there a standing issue, there aren't actually people who are being harmed. They are saying there might be people who would be harmed, and so this can't be allowed to go forward. That is horrible. That's horrible law. It's horrible writing. It's horrible thinking. But it was kicked into being by an executive order so drastically incompetent and so without limit and without sort of reasonable clearance, where people would have said in the course of its clearance through the administration, you can't say that. That doesn't really pass muster because of this or that or the other thing. So you need to calibrate that phrase and do this and do that. That's not what happened. This was, you know, from what we can tell, it was Steve Bannon and Stephen Miller, and they had this idea that they needed to rush this in so A, Trump could say he did it, B, be shock and awe, and C, it seems to me, it shows a real fear that it's like they've got this toy that's the presidency and someone's going to take it away really fast, so they better like get a lot – they get the most use out of it they possibly can until the bad people come and take the toy away from them.
You know, and the thing is, if we're only a few weeks in, this could be setting the stage for a building sort of arms race of activism, you know, of mutual activism on the executive part and on the judicial part. And, you know, you could see a situation in which more sloppily, recklessly drafted executive orders have people hoping for sort of bad
right.
Judicial activism just to sort of save a situation.
And more power grabs, by the way, because right. You have this growing phenomenon that started in the mid-1990s of states attorneys general banding together to effectively create a nationwide caucus of complaint or objection. And thus sort of, you know, claiming somehow, because they are not just one state but a multiplicity of states, that they have standing to attack a national piece of legislation, which is itself an unprecedented idea. And it started in some ways because of this deal that they all simultaneously sued the tobacco companies and got this giant settlement from the tobacco companies, which was effectively in violation of the Commerce Clause of the First Amendment, because they don't have the power to regulate interstate commerce, but they were claiming essentially the power to do just that because they were suing together across state lines. somebody would have had to sort of take that up and force the question. But so you have the possibility of all sorts of independent actors. You have here the Attorney General of Washington State, who's never had so much attention in his life, saying things like, I really hope that the White House takes us to, you know, the Supreme Court, because then we can do discovery on what was going on while the executive order was drafted, which is insane. You don't do discovery on the White House. These are co-equal branches of government. The court doesn't have the right to allow a suing lawyer to claim discovery rights over the minutes or discussions inside the White House. That itself breaks down all constitutional norms also. But I think because liberals and the left believe that the Trump administration represents an unprecedented threat to our civil liberties and our republic, that basically all bets are off, all standards are thrown out the window.
And wait till the administration really gets busy with its deregulation agenda. Which is something that the left is going to not only freak out about, but also lump in with the crazy, with the sort of, oh, this is more crazy runaway administration stuff. I think it's, you know, sort of welcome sound policy for the most part.
Right. Well, there was a delicious story today or yesterday where, you know, somebody at the EPA and somebody at some other department, you know, had spent 2 years crafting regulations to make sure that streams on the top of the mountains weren't something or other, and something called the Congressional Review Act, a piece of legislation that allows Congress to review the effect of regulations, was invoked against them, and basically these regulations were sort of shoved to the side, and it was like, we're so devastated, we've been working so hard, and it's so devastating. It's like, good, that's, you should be devastated. Your side lost, and this is not the, you know, you think you just get to do anything that you want to. Everything that happens in this country is supposed to be subject to the fiat and the choice of the voters, and the voters chose a different path, and trust me, we were all devastated when, you know, when Obama did terrible regulatory things that we didn't like. So now it's your turn. Enjoy being devastated.
This, I put this out on Twitter the other day, and I got no satisfactory response to
it. I'm sorry about that.
This, to me,
Twitter. Yeah, we should always get satisfaction from Twitter.
I wondered.
Twitter is the
resented
new.
Resented your absence.
Twitter is
Twitter
the
feed.
New Athenaeum. It is the public forum in which philosophers gather to express themselves and to
swear,
have the greatest have the greatest form of public debate.
And troll you, and report your tweets.
Yes.
So why is it that immigration restrictionists, people for whom this administration is likely the black swan event, the once-in-a-lifetime affair in which it'll never be repeated, this is Halley's Comet, why are immigration restrictionists not demanding a head should roll? Why aren't they saying that Stephen Miller has so badly mishandled their agenda that he should at least face some sort of consequences instead of going back to the drawing board and reviewing this executive order and doing precisely what they could do within the legal confines of what is perfectly acceptable executive authority to restrict legal and illegal immigration from the White House? They have now backed themselves into a corner in which they are defending to the death this executive order. They're going to go to court over this executive order. They're going to talk about this executive order. It's not in effect. They're going to defend this currently stayed executive order until it is, I guess, reviewed by the Supreme Court and either upheld or abandoned. And that could take months. So in the meantime, we're losing all this time. And why are immigration restrictionists not really, really mad about that?
Well, since no one gave you a satisfactory answer, what do you propose the reason is?
Well, if I had to get inside their heads, I would imagine it's because they want the fight more than the policy.
Yeah, well, that's part of it. I think the other way to look at it is that for the first time they have an administration that has their back, that believes what they believe, that signals its virtue to them in the way that they want the virtue to be signaled to them, that it's okay to believe that all, you know, that
again, the fight over the policy.
But it's not the fight over the policy. This is actually a question of whether or not what you want is, you know, sensible administration, immigration restriction, or whether you want the cultural signifier of an administration that says that you're right, that this country is being overrun either by, you know, potential dangerous terrorists or, you know, or Mexicans or whatever, and that as long as they're on your side, they get 90% of the credit. that affecting, you know, affecting change is important, but you know, give them time. And you know, for the first time, look, nobody. Reagan came out effectively, even though Jimmy Carter was pro-life or nominally pro-life, as he claimed. Reagan was the first pro-life president. I mean, Roe v. Wade had only happened 7 years before his election. He never did a thing to restrict abortion. In fact, his first Supreme Court choice, Sandra Day O'Connor, was basically pro-choice. He never did a thing. But he respected the pro-life community. He talked in their vocabulary. He supported them morally. And he said, I am one of you. And that, it turned out, was vitally important to them. When there was a president who had been pro-choice, George H.W. Bush, he had to deliver on policy. He had to install pro-life people at HHS. He had to talk pro-life. He had to do all kinds of things that Reagan didn't have to do, because they sort of knew he wasn't really on their side, and so he had to show fealty to them in this way.
I suppose that's true in a way, but the analogy sort of fails me here, because it's like if the Reagan administration had pursued pro-life policies, had lost, and then had proceeded to dig their hole as deep as they possibly could and lose ground for the pro-life side, rather than affect
actual
change.
But first of all,
change.
It's too early to say that that's what's going to happen here. And, you know, they feel like they've died and gone to heaven because, you know, they've been dismissed as, you know, cranks and lunatics for years. And now, you know, the president and his senior people issued a very radical document the first week that he was in office that was badly drafted and badly thought through and may have been incompetent, but its heart was in the right place. And you know, the truth is, as they must say to each other, if you really dug deep, you know they wanted to go a lot further, and they restrained themselves. They do want a Muslim ban. He does want a Muslim ban. We want a Muslim ban. But they knew they couldn't do a Muslim ban, so they did less. And now they're in trouble for it, and God bless them. That's what I think.
I think you're right, and I think it's a really astute point. And what it says to me is that they're getting a therapeutic value out of this.
And they should.
Right.
But they should. It is a very meaningful thing. This should not be overlooked. Noah, you're focused on, you know, the ends, but having your view.
Well, just to clarify, yeah. Hold that thought, because I want you to finish. But just to clarify, the ends are also the having driven your enemies before you. I mean, that's part of it. Is they want to see the fight, and they want to see the people
always,
who called them
the
crazy
right.
lose this fight, which is why they're also okay with this big, long, prolonged battle while their policy preferences are in, you know, stasis.
Right. So it's all mixed together. But in other words, who are you going to support? You're going to be mad. You're going to be mad at Stephen Miller. You're not going to be mad at Stephen Miller. He's your guy. Okay. So he's a kid. He got it wrong. You know, he was trying to get it through before anyone could see it. Maybe it was the right strategy. Maybe it was the wrong. But he's your guy. He's the one. He's your guy. He's sticking with you.
But
he feels for you. He's been doing this for years. Sessions been doing it for years. They're your guy.
But this strikes me that this sort of therapeutic politics is yet something else that Trump brought over from the left. I mean, this is a very kind of left thing. It's the enthusiasm about intentions.
Right. Well, so identity politics on the right and the left have different meanings, right? So identity politics on the right, on the left, is group identity politics, right? As we understand it, sort of what you do for African Americans, what you do for the LGBT community, what you do for Hispanics, what you do for Native Americans, what you do for the disabled, what you do for, you know, so
and
you
who
break
you
it
disenfranchise.
Down. Okay, fair. Now, identity politics exists on the right, and it's mostly driven by issues. How do you identify? Do you identify as a Christian? If you identify as a Christian, there's all this stuff that's being done to you, and the question is, does Trump have your back or not? And, you know, this 81% vote by evangelicals for Trump was an indication that when it came down to it, he could say what he said about Access Hollywood. He could be divorced as many times as he wanted. But he said he didn't like those restrictions. He didn't like the stuff with the baking. And these evangelical heads knew that, you know, Hillary coming in was the end of them. And so he's fine with them. So that's one form of identity. Guns is another form of identity politics. Abortion is another form of identity politics. And immigration is now the leading form of identity politics on the right, I would say. Though there are other, you know, there are other minor ways of looking at it, and there are many people who identify as conservative who are not, who are nowhere near as hostile to immigration as the Trumpian consensus would have it. You know, who just think, you know, it's a mess and you it needs to be legal and all of that.
That antipathy is sort of manifest in anti-trade sentiment,
right? But you know, it's still the case. If you poll people, 50 to 60% of people think that immigration is a net benefit to the United States, and that includes Republicans. So that number flipped a lot after the election into negative territory. But the truth is, a lot of people are, you know, perfectly happy with immigration, but they're also happy to hear that someone is like going to enforce the law and, you know, make people speak English and, you know, try to make sure that we have a common culture in the United States. So that's how the identity politics differs. And Trump is very much the first real identity politics president of the right, the way that Obama was the really the first identity politics president of the left. Remember, the whole thing about Clinton when he came in 92 was he was the opposite of right. He was a Southern – he broke the Republican lock on the South because he was heterodox on issues, right? He was for the death penalty. You know, he talked about how abortion was bad. He wanted various things. He tried to come across as a moderate in an increasingly identity politics context. And Obama ran as a liberal. He said he was a liberal. He came in and it was very much, you know, give everybody what they want in the way that they want it. Approve gay marriage, you know, total commitment to affirmative action, you know, total ultimately total commitment to, you know, pandering to Hispanics and their groups with the Dreamers Act and various other forms of immigration support. And now we have his counterweight, which is the conservative identity politics of issues as opposed to groups.
Well, we also have some groups too. I mean, not just the ones that you mentioned, but we've now adopted the quote-unquote white working class.
But that's not a group. That's actually a gigantic block. Like, you can't even call that a group.
Of whom they are now voting very much in a block fashion.
Yeah, but if that's the case, they could never be considered a block before because they were too numerous. Remember, the whole secret of identity politics is it's the stitching together of actual minority groups. You know, 12% of the country is black. 7% of the country is Hispanic, 4% is Asian, 3% is gay. You know, you stitch them together. What defines them as being a minority? The Trump secret, and the secret of this, one of the secrets of this election, is taking a majority and making it feel as though it's a minority and that has to vote as a bloc to get its due, right?
Trump didn't do that. Democrats did that.
Well, they did it. Either way, Trump benefited from the backlash that led to that, let's say, right?
Because but it was something like seven
creating
to...
white consciousness was a great get was a remarkable unintended consequence of the Obama administration. Now you could say that was because he was so horrifying that he turned everybody racist if you want to. But it was this notion that if this is the way things are going to get sorted and you get things because of, you know, what you what your identity is, then okay, I'm a white guy, give me something.
Yeah, well, it was also the fact that it was something like 7 out of 10 white people without a college degree voted for Trump, something like that. It was
right.
A huge, huge block.
Right.
And it had
and
a lot
still
to
the
do.
Largest. It would still count as the, if you were using that as a block definition, it's the largest. It's a plurality of Americans.
Right.
Compared to other groups, compared to college-educated whites, college-educated anybodies, and non-college-educated minorities.
And he wasn't a passive player in this. It was also the anti-trade sentiment and the, you know, the notion that they would somehow correct for the Obama era's attacks on white Christian minorities, which isn't all the Obama administration either. I mean, there's a crisis of attacks on Christianity throughout the world, and you can't blame for Christians for being aware of that.
Not at all. Nor do I think that. Nor do I think anyone should poo-poo the issue of the astounding use of the regulatory and administrative state to start what is effectively a religious war against believing Christians, and you know attempting to throw people in jail because they or you know close their businesses down because they were asked to do things that were inimical to their deepest core beliefs of their faith, and faiths precede. Faiths like family are supposed to be things that are separate and apart from country. I mean, you know, and so that was a, that's a real thing. You can't just, you know, wave your hand and say that's just racism or bigotry. I mean, you can. Plenty of people did, and then they have now reaped the whirlwind from it.
Well, but here's a potentially scary thought. So among – there was a not insignificant portion of Obama supporters who came around to saying things like, you know, he let me down. I really thought he was going to do more. In the end, he conformed to what the system and tradition sort of expected of him. If we proceed with the analogy, where do let down Trump voters go? Should they be let down?
That's
in the
what
long
I
term?
Find completely terrifying. This is J.D. Vance's book, right? I mean, this is the precise impact or the precise trajectory of where this sort of displacement of, you know, agency in your life eventually gets you to. Now it's on the shoulders of a president who's not doing especially well in his third week of office. Maybe he can turn this thing around. He's got plenty of time to do so.
That's a lot of weeks.
He's got plenty of time to do so. But at the same time, right now, if you're a Trump supporter, you're getting off that train. If you're only looking at Gallup polling, where it's now down 15 points underwater in his third week. People are getting off the bus.
Okay, you got two different kinds of Trump voters then. You really have to separate. So you have base core Trump voters, and then you have people who voted for Trump because they voted for the Republican, or they vote because they didn't want to vote for Hillary or whatever, who are, you know, some people call them in polling terms of the reluctant Trump voter or the, you know, or the you know, unemotional Trump voter or something like that. So it will be very hard for the base Trump voter to get off the Trump train. But that number, as I think we saw even in the Republican primaries, is, you know, around 25 to 30% of the national electorate. So the question is, you know, some significant part of his vote is a vote that not particularly for him, but for the party, for the, you know, against the person he was running against. The danger that he has is that those people, and that's what the suggestion is of this first few weeks of polling, those people will back away from him over time, absent successes that were what they deem to be successes. So if you're the sort of person who voted for him because you wanted to shake things up, not because you loved him or because you thought he was the greatest thing since sliced bread, but you wanted, okay, so he's sort of shaking things up. So right now, you may not be all that inclined to say what he's doing is wrong. It's so early. We don't know yet. But if it kind of looks like this 9 months from now, and it could, I mean, he is a sower of chaos. The chaos and instability and uncertainty is what sits atop this administration. It's not just because he's not hiring the right people and he's, you know, they're all new and they're learning, they're getting their sea legs. That was true of the Clinton administration in 93. That a whole bunch of people who had never been in Washington before, and they didn't know how to play the game, and they didn't know what the rules were, and they screwed up time and time and time again, and he had a pretty bad first 2 years. But he was not the force of instability. He was not the cause of the instability. He wanted to win. He was a conventional politician with a real understanding of things, and he made the wrong call early on. He went too liberal, too fast. And then when he was able to course correct, he course corrected because he wanted to be a successful president in conventional terms. And Trump could be like this forever. He likes chaos. He likes, you know, to create dissension and, you know, mess. And he seems to thrive on conflict as opposed to steadiness. Almost every president we can think of before him, the whole thing that he wanted to project, Nixon, they all wanted to project, was stability, control, leadership. They were in charge. They had their hand on the tiller. They were steering the ship. And as I say in a piece that will be in commentary next week, he's spinning the wheel. He's not holding the wheel of the Titanic. He's spinning it around so that the ship will go every which way. I'm spinning my hands in the air. I'm doing like visual representation here on a podcast, which is really stupid.
I'm surprised you didn't go with the Game of Thrones metaphor.
That
everyone else is spinning the wheel and that he will break the wheel.
You know what? I didn't even think of that. But he won't break the wheel. He wants to spin the wheel. He's leaving everybody is disoriented and dizzy and slightly nauseated, and he seems to like it that way. So it could be like this for a year. And that's what could drive those reluctant Trump. People want the president to be in charge and to be a calm and soothing and steadying force, not a whirling dervish lunatic.
And yet, here's a little the grain of hope. You see things like today, Walter Russell Mead, very sober, very insightful, great thinker about foreign policy, has assessed Trump's sort of Asian policy so far as a win. All told, despite the crazy outburst, despite the unpredictability, despite the missteps, he said, "Well, you know, it's basically." And the Wall Street Journal, in a very sort of similar vein, came to the same conclusion that, you know, basically he got the China policy for the most part right. We're recognizing one China without forcing ourselves not to deal with Taiwan the way we'd like to. We reaffirmed our connection, our support for Japan in a credible way.
And he objected to the North Korean missile firing. But, I mean, this talk about, like, low bar clearance praise. So because he came around to endorsing the policy of the United States for the last 37 years, and because he said we like Japan, and because he doesn't like the fact that North Korea fires off a missile, he's really got a win going here.
That's what helped, but that's why he will get credit for low bar achievements that no one else will.
No. So Walter gives him credit. I'm saying I don't think anybody's going to give him much credit for that.
Where is that coming from? That's coming from the fact that you have a lot of conservatives who dedicate themselves now exclusively to critiquing the media, who are suggesting that nobody is giving this guy enough credit for doing things that are just essentially, you know, baseline level play school my first day in the presidency stuff that you're supposed to know that you're supposed to do.
Yeah, so as I recall, what happened last week was there's also a Far East, there's also a country in the Far East called Australia, which is also a continent, and we got into a giant fight with Australia. So that's also part of his Asian policy.
Our Asian policy consists of forcing most of our allies into a trade agreement that excludes us with China. That's super great.
Yeah, eventually, right.
Negotiations are on.
Fair enough. And we don't know what he's going to say about India, and we don't know what he's going to say about Pakistan. I'm just saying, like, the notion that you can look at the first three, even assessing, this is the insanity that's gripped us. So it's 3.5 weeks, and we're assessing the successes and failures of administration. Like, they don't even have people in key jobs yet. 12 cabinet posts have yet to be confirmed. You know, they should just be like, you know, like setting up the computer systems. It's all because really Trump and Bannon like jumped off a ledge in trying to like get things going, that he's in the mess that he's in now. Totally, and all of these self-inflicted wounds that are, you know, I mean, in the end, that's the thing about the executive order. So what if he'd waited 5 weeks to issue the executive order and, like, gone through a drafting process with people they could trust? So it wasn't that they had Sessions and they had a deputy AG and they had a solicitor general who could assess this and give good comments, and then he announced it 5 weeks from now. What difference would it have made? Oh, okay. A terrorist would have come in through the Syria port, you know? So that's going to happen now anyway since the stay is on. So congratulations, you know, if he'd waited 5 weeks. If the stay's on for a year and a terrorist comes in, if he drafted it better, he may want to blame the courts. But not that I think a terrorist
like you said, what's their incentive structure for this if their core group is always going to be with them because of, you know, sentimentality?
Because you don't win because of your core group. You have to have more people than your core. If you melt down to your core, that's Bush in 2008. That's like Bush left with the 30% of people or 28% of people who think he's great and will like him regardless or admire him or respect him. If Bush had to run for re-election in 2008, it would have been a wild calamity, obviously. You know, you need to build your support. He was elected with 46%. He needs to build his support, not retract it and not shrink it and not offend the people who voted for him because they saw no other choice. He wants to make them happier with their choice. He wants to make them, you know, George W. Bush in 2004 got 22% more votes than he got in 2000. That is what Trump needs to do to be successful. He needs to do better, not to revert, not to sort of retreat into his base. I mean, that's just simple practical politics. The Democrats may make this easy for him because they're totally insane, and they've gone totally insane, and their response to him will not be to occupy the center that he seems unwilling to occupy, but to move far to the left and thus leave the center unoccupied and make him effectively the center because he's the national leader. If they move to the center and like tried to be a centrist party, you know, the world could be their oyster, but that does not appear to be what is going to go on here. So with that, we come to the end of our first podcast of the week. Commentary Magazine, the 72-year-old monthly of intellectual probity, critical analysis. Join us at commentarymagazine.com, where we give you some free reads, and then we ask you to subscribe for $19.99. A digital subscription, $29.99. A all-access subscription featuring our beautiful monthly magazine in your mailbox. We're closing our March issue today and tomorrow. It's got some amazing, fantastic stuff in it. We'll be releasing over the course of the week. Including a major essay by Nicholas Eberstadt called Our Miserable 21st Century, which is an uncommonly depressing piece of writing, befitting Commentary's new position as the spangler of the Trump administration. Have a happy Valentine's Day, everybody. It's my sister's birthday, so wish my sister a happy birthday somewhere if you can, if you're friends with her on Facebook or on Twitter. Go wish Ruthie Bloom a happy birthday, February 14th. I'm John Podhoretz for Noah Rothman and Abe Greenwald. Keep the candle burning.